Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, what can the history of human rights tell us about the struggles of today? Then, the former Speaker of the Israeli Parliament discusses the spiritual crisis of Israel and how it affects the Middle East. Then, on the Scholar Circle, our panel argues that warring is a relatively new phenomenon in human societies. Human rights are rights held by individuals simply because they are human, says our next guest. The idea of human rights stretches back throughout the history of humanity, but it was 1948 when the United Nations reached to the values articulated in the French Revolution to codify the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. What can we learn from the history of human rights? We're joined now by Micheline Ishay. She is professor and director of the International Human Rights Program at the University of Denver. Her book is called The History of Human Rights, From Ancient Times to the Era of Globalization. She's also the editor of the Human Rights Reader. It's great to have you with us, Micheline.
Thank you. Likewise.
I wonder if you could give us kind of an overview in terms of the big contributions. And you went through a lot of them in your book, so maybe focus on the ones that were the greatest gains of where these ideas of human rights came from.
Well, it's interesting, the various components that moved human rights forward and some that might have yielded to a backlash or a setback. For instance, if you think about capitalism, on the one hand, it opened new opportunities for individuals. It created, for instance, the possibility for individuals to claim the right to property against the estate of the nobility. It enables individuals to say, I want also the possibility to participate in the political forum in which I reside. So capitalism, in a way, and the Enlightenment opened enormous amount of room for individuals to claim rights that did not exist under feudalism. At the same time, as we arrive to the 19th century, we see the excess of the accumulations of property rights and a new movement which will try to just target on a new agenda of rights, mainly on economic and social rights, suggesting that they are disenfranchised, that they are not able to shrink the economic gaps that exist between those who have and those will unleash a battle throughout the 19th century to claim the right to vote and also to have some form of economic safety net to secure their basic human rights. So here we see throughout two centuries the development of a host of rights, civil, political, and economic rights. And by the time you arrive in the 20th century, as an effort to break colonial empires, we will see the erection of new countries who will actually ask for their right to self-determination and their cultural rights. So in effect, those are the great trends that will be later encoded in the various bills of rights, starting from the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948, and then the Covenant of Civil and Political Rights and Covenant of Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights in 1966. So that's sort of, I'm canvassing for you sort of in a broad terms, the main visions of rights throughout the last 300 years.
Fast forwarding to today and the issues that we're facing with globalization, the fight against terrorism, you talk about the challenges that we're facing there, including kind of this global consumerism, what you called a shrinking social space. Talk about the kind of contradictions that come up with these issues.
You can see contradictions in the genus face of globalizations. On the one hand, possibility to connect with individuals across boundaries that is available as a result of the advance of information technology and as a result of some form of economic integration. This enable individuals to transcend their parochialism, some individuals to ask for rights that they didn't even know that exist in countries where there is higher repressions of rights. At the same time, globalization erode traditional loyalties, indigenous culture, might enable investment and open market, but at the same time erode also environmental protection in areas where states are weak. So we have an array of problems that come along with globalization just as some of the benefits. What is interesting is we are in a world in which consumerism has taken over the public space, the physical public space, the place where individuals used to rally and just demand changes to their governments or defeat government's policy. The rally, the public sphere, is no longer what it used to be in the golden age of the 19th century. So with the age of consumerism, people can actually isolate themselves in their household and trying to intervene via the internet or think that they have a capacity of intervention just by watching their television. But it's become shrunk in that sense that it's given illusions that we can reach beyond to space that we were never able to reach initially, but at the same time, we physically have left that capacity to speak with each other in order to make a substantial change. And that's one of the concerns when we are talking about change and human rights struggle. Who is heard? International institutions are surrogates for those who, and lend themselves to the voice that are unheard. But often they forget to represent also the voice that are unheard in that process.
And you also talked about the phenomena of a rising search for an escape from the characteristics of globalism. And in particular, you talk about people kind of trying to decentralize, escaping into their churches, their mosques. But the other side of that is that there is a fundamentalism that has been growing.
Yes, this is one of the aspects that is troublesome from a human rights perspective. The mosque, the temples, and other religious sites provide a more personable place for people to connect with each other. And so there is, to some extent, a return to those sites. People want community, and religious forums provide often that substitute for the more secular community that is in disappearance. The problem is that in places where governments are weak or almost non-existent, and where civil society is fragile, often we see the religious centers to become the vehicle to reclaim the voice for people. The universalist aspect of human rights is lost. Many of those religious sites, particularly in the poor countries, are concerned about poverty. They are not universalistic in the human rights sense. There is still discriminations between men and women, and that is to some extent.
Micheline Ishe, I'd like for you to connect this now with some of the things that you showed historically. For example, you said that some of the kind of bad human rights violations of the past, like from the Industrial Revolution, really spawned new sites for human interaction and forms of resistance. And bring that fast forward to today.
It's true that in a way, in that tale of two cities where you have cities which actually have concentrated during the Industrial Revolutions, poor people who are working in factories, at the same time, those areas become forums for communications. People, as a result of that, are succeeding to developing agenda, political programs, and make demands, developing collective bargaining in a way that was not done and possible when those people lived in the agrarian and feudal site.
It sounded like what you were saying is that with each of these problems that were massive human rights abuses actually created simultaneously opportunities.
True. But those opportunities are not created by themselves. So, yes, history is filled with contradictions, and people can seize those contradictions, though those contradictions may be left to the whims of the visible hand. One needs to seize them and channel forces in directions that are fruitful and beneficial for human rights. Whether the new sites today, the shrinking space of the religious community could become those sites for progressive politics, I think that in a way it is the case if we make it happen.
Well, Micheline Ishe, thank you so much for being with us. This has been just really wonderful having you.
Likewise. Thank you very much.
Stay tuned.
The following interview with the former Speaker of the Israeli Parliament, Avraham Berg, was conducted in January 2009, around the time of the Gaza crisis.
Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. Avraham Berg is the former Speaker of the Israeli Parliament, the Israeli Knesset, and has authored a book called The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. Describe for our listeners the contrast between your vision for Israel and what you're seeing going on with the Gaza crisis.
Sometimes I feel that I'm lost of words, so to say, because on one hand, I see and feel and know the enormous potential, both moral and human and social and of the Israeli society. And on the other hand, when it comes to physical threats against our being, in no time we lose all the wisdom and all the sophistications, and we take the very primitive approach, muscles, weapons, army, military reaction. And that's quite a contrast for a society which represents such a rich and sophisticated civilization like the Jewish one. So what do you have now in Gaza? You have the Israeli society, one of the most sophisticated, high-tech societies, doesn't know how to deal with a confined misery in Gaza, so it reacts the only way it knows to react, in a military way, which is, for me, a tragedy.
You've talked a bit about what the original Zionist idea is, and that it wasn't really just about saving the Jewish people, but it was an idea of establishing a model society that is giving to all citizens freedom and all citizens the kind of humanity that it wished for itself.
You know, sometimes when I listen to my kids who serve in the army or coming back from reserve service or listen just to the Israeli talk, I say to myself, I wish I could go back 100 years in time, just 40 years, just a generation before the Holocaust. Then it was the wakening up Jewish people. Then it was a people that was just coming out of the ghetto, just coming out of isolationism and being the pariah of the world, finding integration, finding new horizons for the people. It was a great era, full of hope, full of optimism. And then the not-yet-born state of Israel began its very first steps out of optimism, out of hope. And then the Holocaust came, and in no time, the people who were so full of hope became so full of despair. And the promised land, so to say, became a shelter. And the mentality of us as the citizens of this place is not anymore the mentality of those who really believe in the future of the place, but as much as in the deep shelter and the thick walls of the place as a protection, as a safe haven. And this is, in a way, a waste of a vision. I never survived just in order to survive, never exist in order to exist. Every cat can survive in order to survive. I, as a Jew, feel that I'm driven by a higher call. Will the higher call be the call of liberties and freedom, or be it the call of justice at the times of prophets, or be it something else, but there should be a higher call. And all of a sudden, the call is a very low one, in the sense that we look just at the immediate existential reality and nothing beyond that. And that's, for me, a real waste of a spiritual energy.
If you were in office now, and you have been in office, you were Speaker
right.
of the Knesset, you served in the Knesset for quite some time, which is the Israeli parliament, for listeners who don't know, and engaged in that public life, if you were there now, what would you do about the Gaza crisis?
No, Maria, it's not a fair question. I'm sorry, I resigned from the Knesset. The first reason among many was because I felt that Israel became a very effective and efficient kingdom with no prophecy, no direction, no deeper dimension, no inner self, which is really the real Jewish self the way I know it. And I wanted to distance myself from the immediate executive position in order to find this new prophecy for myself and for my people. Now you draw me back and you say, okay, where are you there in the world of no perspective? What would have been your perspective? I look at wars, and I know that sometimes sovereignties and states have to go out for war. I ask myself, what is the outcome of the war? If the outcome of the war is just the next waiting period for the next war, and the outcome of the war is just a deeper hatred, it's just more animosity, so this war is a failure, and therefore you should not declare it in the first place. But if the outcome of the war is, in a very miraculous dialectic way, the next peace, getting closer to your enemy, like in 73, in which we were surprised by both Syria and Egypt, but the outcome of it was the negotiation with late Anwar Sadat and the peace which lasts up until today between Israel and Egypt. Or will it be the first Palestinian uprising, the first Intifada, which in a very mysterious way brought about the eruption of the then euphoric Oslo later failed because of other reasons, I say there is some logic to the conflict. Now, when I look at the conflict in Gaza, I ask myself, why did we go there? Yes, the state has to find many means and many ways to defend its citizens from random but permanent rocket attacks every day over the southern part of Israel. But if the military operation will not bring about a situation which brings both sides closer to each other, we shouldn't declare it. That should have been my voice, were I in the political circle.
You have said in an op-ed piece that you published in the Los Angeles Times, we could kill 1,000 ringleaders and engineers a day and nothing will be solved because the leaders come up from below.
That's right. That's right. More than I look at leaders, I look at people. And I ask myself, really, the one who was born there, a baby is born with no hatred. So my job or my responsibility or my mission in life is to create about a situation that maybe not overnight, maybe not tomorrow morning, but slowly but surely, less parents will pass the hatred from this generation to next generation, and more parents will raise the kids in an environment of a promising future, saying, look at this Israel, it's a different Israel. The way I was brought up, saying, look at the Palestinians, they are different Palestinians. Now, it's coming from a very, very, very personal story of myself. My late mother was one of the survivors of the 29 massacre in Hebron. Half of the Jews there, dozens of them, were massacred by the local mobsters, and half of the Jews there, my mom included, were saved by a local Arab landlord, which actually was a Palestinian righteous among the nation who saved her. And ever since, my family says, never mind who is the enemy, there should be somebody out there we should begin the conversation with. And I would like to be this Israeli for the Palestinians, and I hope there is somebody out there who will be this man or this woman for me.
Let me remind our listeners that we are speaking with Avraham Berg, who is the former Speaker of the Knesset and the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, where you are speaking, really, your audience is your Jewish community, and you're addressing the role of the Shoah, or the Holocaust,
right,
in everyday living and in politics. Tie that together for our listeners.
The book is a very personal journey of an Israeli who lives within the permanent, omnipresent rhetoric of the Shoah around me, who is a son to a Holocaust survivor. My father ran away from Germany at September 39, the very last moment. I was a leader and a head of many Jewish organizations who dealt with many outcomes of the Holocaust. And my argument is very simple. To remember, we must. To sanctify and to honor, we should never forget. But using the Holocaust as an ongoing political argument, ongoing political instrument, ongoing political equation, by the end of the day, erodes the importance of this unbelievable, unheard of human horror. And I'll give you an example. Here you have Benjamin Netanyahu. When he is being asked, what do you say about the Iranian bomb, about Ahmadinejad, which is a real threat, a real problem, he doesn't even stop for a moment to think, and he says, Iran, Ahmadinejad, it's 1938 all over again. And I say, is it? Did we have such an omnipotent army in 38? Did we have such a powerful, solid state in 38? Did we have the unequivocal support of all the important superpowers of the world in 38? Did we have the Catholic Church new dogma of Nostra Aetate, which is a different dogmatic approach to the Jews in 38? The answer is no. And when you compare everybody to Hitler, don't you, by the end of the day, diminish the size and the importance and the horrific diabolic dimension of Hitler? You do. And I said, remove it from our equation. However, I'm a lone voice because as long as we'll have living witnesses among us, many, many people still live at the corner, at the pole, at the side of trauma. What I try to do in my publications is to tell the Israeli society a day will come very soon that our children will live in a time, in an era, that there will be no living witnesses anymore. Then the Holocaust will be a memory rather than an experience. Then what? Do we want the next generation to be shaped and molded through the trauma, or do we want them to begin slowly but surely the march from trauma to trust? Many say trauma. I say trust. trust the world, trust ourselves, trust our environment.
Now, you've also said in this book, The Holocaust is Over, that there is a Shoah industry.
Yes, but it is wider than this. I care, but it's not that significant for me about all the political and public organizations, be there governmental agencies or non-government or NGOs who deal with it. I'm much more concerned about the psyche, about the mentality, about the psychology of the people, that everything is holocaustic. Everybody around us is Hitler. Every threat is the ultimate threat. Every problem is an existential reality. And I say it is not. People, normalcy, sanity is around the corner, waiting for us to come to it. So yes, we were traumatized. And yes, I know from the very sad personal experience of too many of my friends when they were abused or violated or raped at a very young age, some of them will never come out of the trauma. It happens in individual life. It might, God forbid, happen to the collective life. Absolutely. But those who succeeded to overcome and come out of their inner hell and inner horror are the ones to teach us how to go out of it. And I say, let's go out of it.
This mentality, this living in the shadow of a trauma like this, ultimately on the existential level, do you think this is what is preventing peace in the Middle East?
It is one of the elements. The add-on to this is many among us and many among our friends, when they are saying never again, they mean never again for Jews. And therefore, let's have the strongest army, and let's have the most frightening deterrence power, and let's have the deepest shelter and the thickest walls around us. And I say, never again for me means never again for any victim around the world. Wherever there is a victim, I, the yesterday's victim, must raise my voice and the voice of others and wake the people from their indifference, because the woman in Darfur is the Jew of today. And that's part of my responsibility out of my national and private experience. So one side of it is no doubt that too many here and too many around the world are believing never again for Jews is the issue and do not see a wider picture. When I speak about a wider picture, there is the other side. As much as the Palestinians are my enemies, they are my potential neighbors. And I ask myself why it doesn't work. And one of the reasons it doesn't work, because too many of our leaders, and world leaders as well, believe that the issue between us and the Palestinians is the issue of a real estate, where the line will go. You'll have this part of the land, and I'll have 5 acres there, and you have 2% of the swap, and this and that. And I say, ladies and gentlemen, it's not about real estate. It's about something else. If we will not address their fears and traumas, and they have fear and traumas, and they will not address our fears and traumas, and we shall help each other to overcome what troubles us, without the psychological introduction or preamble, you'll never have the real story. And therefore, even a peace process should begin with traumas and fears.
Bringing it back also to the issues in your book, you have a chapter specifically about the Weimar Republic and remembering it and the similarities that you have been seeing in your own state. Would you describe what you mean by that?
Analogies are always a problem, because if there is only 1% which is not exactly like the argument, everybody argues about the 1% and turns the eye to the 99%. But I thought, what kind of a mirror can I put in front of the Israeli audience? So I thought maybe it's about the Native Americans and the first pioneers. And I said, no, this is not the point. And then I thought about France and North Africa, and I said, again, this is not the point. And then I thought about Germany. And Germany has something to do with us very deep. The two most important creation written about the modern Jewish people, the positive and the negative, were written there in the German language. It was Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf in German, and it was Theodor Herzl, The State of the Jews, or the Jewish State, in German as well. There is something very deep there at the competition between evilness and a positive solution to the issues and the topics of my people. When I look deeper into it, I realize that the Second Reich, between Bismarck and the end of the Weimar Republic, had a very unique competition into it between a national humiliation and a lot of hope. Germany was humiliated by the family of nations, was actually abused by the family of nations, and at the same time, new spirits of freedoms and liberty and creativity and arts and this and that erupted there like never before anywhere around the world. And this competition between trauma and hope was there for a couple of decades, and eventually and unfortunately, the trauma won, and Germany became what it became. In Israel as well, there is a competition between traumas and hopes and creativity and arts and liberties and freedoms. And I say to my people, beware that if and when, God forbid, the melancholic spirits will overcome the hopeful one, it's a recipe for a disaster. That was the comparison.
And when you look at the current state of Israel today, what is it that you think needs to happen from this point forward? How do we get from where we are today to this greater vision?
Part of the solution, Oric, is out of this region. I ask myself, why is it so that the 90s was such a promising reconciliatory decade? Why is it so that the wall came down in Berlin? And then later on, an 800-year-old conflict in North Ireland was resolved, and the apartheid was over, and the then euphoric Oslo looked like a promising new dialogue between Israelis and Palestinians. And now, the first decade of the 21st century is so full of blood and animosity and violence and Tora Bora and Twin Towers. What happened? So many things happened. There are many explanations. I'll offer you one. The head of the free world, the president of our civilization, is the president of the United States of America. If in the White House sits a dialogist, the world talks. If in the White House sits a cowboy who shoots you first and then shoots you again and then tries to talk to you, the world shoots. Everybody says, yes, George Bush was the best president for the state of Israel. And I say, I'm sorry, but he was the worst ever. Because the president at the White House is like a parent at the family. A parent who doesn't know how to say no to the child does not do good to him, does not educate correctly the child. And the American president allowed us to do things never to be done in this region, according to his style. What do we need here to resume hope, to resume dialogue, to resume reconciliation? Is again a dialogist at the White House. And my expectation from President Barack Obama is exactly this, to resume the conversation. So that's the first thing. The second is an international responsibility to come here and say, on one hand, we are ready to help you, both Israelis and Palestinians, to unlock your horns. But on the other hand, we want you to know that we are concerned not just because of you in a very paternalistic way, but because a volatile Middle East is a threat to the well-being of the Western world and the Western civilization and Western democracies. And therefore, we must resolve this issue with an external persuasion, so to say, on the parties themselves. Then it comes to us and the Palestinians. When it comes to us and the Palestinians, we have to realize, as I said before, the psychological dimension, and we have to realize more than that. It is not about leadership. The people are already our side. The people are already their side. We have to address what troubles them, and this is the ever-expanding settlements, so be ready to remove all the settlements and all the settlers and all the roadblocks and all the military presence which actually suffocate them away from the place and let them live their own life. And they must put an end, an active end, to the culture of hatred and incitement coming out of the mosques and schools. We listen to the next generation and we are troubled. If we will be persuaded that the next Palestinian generation is not about to clone and to repeat and to copy the hatred and the frustration of the previous generation, and they will be assured that we are not about to reconquer and recolonize their own land, I believe there is a potential that the incitement and settlements will not collide again in such a volatile, bloody way.
With Obama, you have expressed some hope that he will reestablish dialogue. With AIPAC, with the strength that it has, which is the American-Israel Public Affairs Council, do you think that he really will be able to negotiate fairly?
First, it's a test to his leadership. Will he be a puppet of AIPAC like previous presidents, or will he be an independent one? Now, I know that there are three political entities here, the State of Israel, the United States of America, and the independent state of AIPAC. that having its own set of priorities and its own value system, I don't think that they are working on behalf of the state of Israel, maybe the radical right parts of Israel, and I don't think they represent the American interest. But, you know, when crucial times came, eventually great American presidents knew what's the real interest of Israel through the veil or through the screen of APAC threats. And that's the way Obama should act. He should act according to the real, authentic voices of both the Israelis and the Palestinians. All of them are looking at him, and he's the president of the free world.
Well, Avraham Berg, I want to say thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Maria.
Avraham Berg is the former speaker of the Israeli parliament, the Israeli Knesset, and has authored a book called The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. When we come back, our panel argues that warring is a relatively new phenomenon in human society. Stay tuned. Hello and welcome back to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. George Orwell wrote about a time of perpetual war for perpetual peace. And war has defined eras and played a central role in our politics and culture. But our next panel argues that warring is not the norm, that it may be a relatively new phenomenon, and that human beings are not warlike by nature. Their research is part of the book War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views. Douglas Fry is Director of Peace Mediation and Conflict Research at Abo Akademi University in Finland and Research Scientist at the University of Arizona. He's the author of Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace, and the editor of War, Peace, and Human Nature, The Convergence of Evolutionary and Cultural Views. Darshan Narvaez is professor of psychology at the University of Minnesota and co-author of numerous books, including Evolution, Early Experience in Human Development, and Personality, Identity, and Character, Explorations in Moral Psychology. R. Brian Ferguson is professor of anthropology at Rutgers University, and he is author of numerous publications such as Full Spectrum, The Military Invasion of Anthropology, Born to Live, Challenging Killer Myths, and Yanomami Warfare, A Political History. Thank you so much for being with us. All three of you argue that war is really not the norm and that we're not warlike by nature. So let's start with the broad strokes of what and where the evidence is. Doug Fry, let's start with you. You've been studying peaceful societies. Who are they and what do they tell us about humanity?
There are peaceful societies, both internally peaceful, meaning that there's not much violence in the societies, and usually they have an ethic of nonviolence. But for this topic, we're more interested in the non-warring societies. If you look at the cross-cultural database, most societies do engage in war, but some do not. So the basic sort of ground argument here is that if some don't, it's certainly not something that's programmed rigidly into humanity's genes. But for this book, War, Peace, and Human Nature, I sort of take a new slant on this and consider the whole idea of restraint. And I'm talking about restraint against physical aggression, and try to contextualize the human animal within the primate order and also within other animal species. And the key idea there, we do an awful lot of avoiding of conflict, period, and sometimes we get into our verbal fights, and we could call those displays, analogous to displays in other animals, but rather very little of our conflict behavior actually involves anything physical at all. And this is just something that we all take for granted all the time. We don't expect to be hit as we just go around our lives, generally. We don't expect to be killed or kill anybody. We're really actually a pretty docile species, as are most other primates.
So what you're saying is really it's an anomaly to be physically violent, particularly lethally violent.
Yeah, particularly lethally violent. And here, of course, we're talking about everything, homicide and so forth. We calculate homicide rates in 100,000 per year. And they can range from virtually nothing, less than one per 100,000 per year, up to a so-called high homicide rate of 50 per year. A statistic I came across recently was if you add up during the World War II years in Europe, all of the domestic homicides plus all of the war deaths, it's somewhere in the range of about 500 per year per 100,000, which is like half of 1% of the population being killed during World War II in Europe. So, I mean, even under these extreme situations, that's not a high rate of killing just numerically. Of course, this is tragic for all the people who lost their lives and their loved ones. I don't mean to minimize it in any way. But again, I'm just trying to take a slant on this, which really goes in the face of the types of theories we hear all the time in the popular media that we're killer apes and that killing is in our genes and warfare is natural. We've always had war, always will have war. I really don't think the data shows that at all.
You did mention our closest species, the chimpanzees and the bonobos, and you wrote about them a little bit in the book, and you noted that one is a little bit more aggressive while the other isn't. How does it relate to what we're talking about here?
The bonobos and chimpanzees and humans are basically the three apes, you know, including humans as an honorary ape. We're all equally related to each other, but we're all different species. So we do have our own particular evolutionary trajectories, if you will. Chimpanzees tend to be more dominant and more aggressive. But the idea is we can't really use either one of those species just in of itself as some sort of model for human. My position is that we should look at our own species and how we behave, have some general frame of reference. Bonobos are rather unaggressive. Chimpanzees have been shown to kill members of other groups in the wild and in captivity. All of this emphasis has been placed, again, in popular press as well as with some colleagues on chimpanzees as being the species to look to try to get insights about human nature. And I really question that. We're obviously unique. So obviously, amongst our closest relatives, we have an ability to be lethally aggressive, and the other species, the bonobos, don't do this. So here we are humans. Yeah, we sometimes do this, but most of the time, actually, we don't do it either. So this is where my studies of hunter-gatherers comes in. If you take a cross sample, a sample of these basic, most archaic type of human societies we spent our human existence in for most of our species past, some of those groups are somewhat aggressive in terms of homicides and so forth. Others are extremely peaceful. So this brings a sort of full circle to your first question about peaceful societies. It's very possible to live without war, without feuding, with very low homicide rates. And in fact, my numbers show that about 29% of the sample of nomadic hunter-gatherers have very low homicide rates and do not engage in war. And if we just are looking at warfare, it's 62% of this sample that I deal with do not engage in warfare. So this sort of is a criticism of this assumption that, yes, whack, in the past there was warfare and this is in our nature.
Brian Ferguson, you've also said that this idea of human nature being warlike is empirically unsupportable.
Right. I'll start by responding to the idea about chimpanzees and bonobos. This is a work in progress, and my view is that the difference between chimpanzees and bonobos in terms of the intergroup relations and aggressiveness is not as different as, in an inborn sense, as people have thought it to be. There are differences. These two species have been separated by about 2.5 million years of evolution, so there could be hormonal differences that affect their aggressiveness. But when you look carefully at the record about both of these species, you find examples of chimpanzees, especially in some of the very early observations that were done by Jane Goodall at Gombe, two different chimpanzee groups meeting in ways that is virtually indistinguishable from the way bonobo groups have been observed to meet. On the other hand, you have bonobo groups that, although there is not any recorded case of a lethal encounter between two groups, there is a lot of antagonism and sometimes actual physical fighting. There's real differences in the basic female bonding orientation of bonobos, where among chimpanzees, females don't bond to the same degree, at least in most cases, although some of them do. So there is a real difference there, but is it something that's built into their genes, hardwired, or is this a result of long-term adaptive changes associated with different kinds of ecologies? And what I emphasize in my work, the specifics of how human behavior has impacted on their environments, which has been different for bonobos than it's been for some chimpanzee groups.
The other aspect of this notion that war is human nature is empirically unsupportable.
Right.
You actually started with that quote that Barack Obama gave when he took his Nobel Peace Prize, that war in one form or another appears with the first man. You say that's not true. Why?
Well, it's not true. It's a common belief. Everybody, quote, knows it's true. It's a projection, modern-day conditions. This has been taken to an intellectual level most recently by Steven Pinker. Steven Pinker, in his book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, draws on two other researchers, Lawrence Keeley and Bowles, and also by LeBlanc. These are people who have written about the antiquity of war, and comes up with a list that supposedly demonstrates that among what they call prehistoric populations, that the average is 15% of the population dies in war, and a quarter of more of the men die in war. And this is the average. The research I've done, I've gone through the cases that they use for this, and there's a lot of problems with what I call Pinker's list. He, for example, counts some cases twice, and he counts three cases where there's one individual who's dead by violence as a case of war, and just can't do that because homicide could be the explanation. The ones that are valid examples of multiple deaths, where you can really say there's at least two people here who've been killed, seeming to indicate war, that these are cherry-picked cases. These are exceptional cases. They do not represent prehistoric people, often from their very violent periods and times, and sometimes within the violent periods and times, they stand out as the most violent of all. So the alternative method of dealing with this is to look at the total archaeological record, which I've done. I've done for North America, I've done for Europe, and I've done for the Near East. And all of the cases that appear in Pinker's list, they're all covered there, but they're put in context. And when you put them in context, what you see is this. The very earliest records we have, the very earliest archaeological remains, which aren't much, we've got maybe 100 pieces of skeletal remains from Paleolithic Europe, that there is one instance of what looks like a violent death of a child. When you come forward in time in this period that's known as the Mesolithic, which is before agriculture, but when you generally had larger populations and more complex societies, then you begin to get in some places, but not others, good signs of war. So it precedes agriculture, but it's very sporadic. And in some places where you have it, later on in the same place you don't have it. When you get to agriculture, just leave it with Europe and the Near East because North America is more complicated. In most places, there's a period that ranges from 500 years to 1,500 years where you don't see evidence of war, and then gradually the signs of war begin to appear and become more unmistakable and more developed, more intense. And it's evident, it's obvious. And this is not, as I am often challenged, a case of absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. In other words, people say, because you don't find evidence of war, doesn't mean there wasn't any war there. It means you just haven't found the evidence. War leaves behind lots of archaeologically recoverable traces. And in the archaeological record, there is tons and tons and tons of irrefutable evidence of war out there. What I'm talking about is situations where you've got good archaeological evidence going over very long periods of time. No evidence of war in the earlier phases, good evidence of war in the later phases, without any kind of sharp increase in the recovery. In other words, the amount of material we're getting that could show war isn't getting any better. What's happening is the evidence of war is showing up. And the reasonable inference from that is that war has begun in those areas.
Darsha Novais, you've looked at the cultural aspect and you've compared, say, Western culture with other cultures. What have you found?
Let me just say a few words about the culture that emerged among foraging nomadic bands. It's quite different than what we normally hear from Steven Pinker and others. For example, they really have a companionship culture from the moment of birth on. Every individual in the society is considered part of the self, more of a common self orientation. Animals and other entities are part of that common self, so they have a great respect for the environment, typically. There's a high sense of individualism. People are not coerced into any kind of behavior, even children, and yet they have a great sense of collective group identity in the group that they're in at the time. But they shift in and out of groups, and they're related to others in other groups nearby. They also seem to have a sustainable orientation to life in living as they go from feeding ground to feeding ground nomadically. They do not use up all the resources because they know they're going to have to come back in the next cycle. And they're very cooperative across groups. And there are other characteristics too, but let me just say that one of the key areas that we have changed from that lifestyle is how we raise children. And my colleagues and I are studying what we call the evolved developmental niche. And this is the caregiving context that our bodies and brains developed to need in relation to the maturational schedule of a baby, for example. And every animal has this developmental niche for their offspring, especially humans, because we're born so young with only 25% of the brain in place at birth, full-term birth. And these practices are all now related to health outcomes and well-being outcomes, and my lab is looking at moral outcomes and how they affect moral development in young children. These characteristics include breastfeeding extensively, 2 to 5 years among hunter-gatherer groups. And breast milk, we know, populates the gut with all the proper probiotic bacteria that lead to lifelong health and has all the immunoglobulins for the immune system to develop. And that takes a while, takes many years to develop that. That's why the breastfeeding lengths in part are so long. Another characteristic is touch. Children are held, carried, and slept with all the time when they're young. And that touch is known to help development as well and growth and all sorts of things, calmness. Another one is the responsiveness to the needs of the baby. You don't let babies cry it out, which is quite popular at the moment now. We know that has all sorts of poor effects on children's development in many ways. Another one is free play. Babies are ready to play almost from the day they're born to have a companionship care. Another one is multiple adult caregivers. Moms and dads can't do this alone. Babies need a lot of attention, and 50% of the time in some of these foraging bands, other adults were taking care of the baby, not mother. And then finally, natural childbirth, not in separating mom and baby or interfering with the timing of birth. And we've kind of gone against all these practices in the U.S. in the 20th century, and we're finding that each of these matter for moral development, three-year-olds, empathy development, conscience, self-regulation, and so forth. What happens when you don't have this early care, this evolved developmental niche, your brain systems for self-regulation are undermined. The vagal nerve, for example, doesn't get set properly, and that's related to calming yourself for social relationships, the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that is related to stress response is also misset up. And those things make you stress reactive. And when you're stress reactive, it shuts down the blood flow to the higher order thinking, the neocortex. It shuts down or it decreases compassion. And so you're more likely to be more aggressive.
It kind of leads into where I wanted to go here, which is if, in fact, what your work says is true, which is that war developed and was not necessarily with the first man, as Barack Obama had said, how did we get here? Doug Fry, would you like to start on that?
Basically, it's a social organization feature as I see it. Darsha was talking a bit about the nomadic hunter-gatherers. It's just such a different lifestyle than we're living today in our modern nation states with these populations of, you know, zillions of people that we see every day. It's a little hard, I think, for us in the 21st century to conceptualize just how far we have come, for better or for worse. But Darsha is pointing out that there are many things that were out of touch, I would say, with the way that our species has evolved, and therefore some of our critical needs for morality as well as a whole variety of other behaviors. So we're coming from a situation where basically there was a lot of restraint on the aggression. And the other aspect of the hunter-gatherer type of lifestyle that we're coming from is the disputes tended to be very personal. The disputes are more often than not over a woman, or if someone has been insulted in some way, there's been a theft or something like this. Most of the disputes are actually not lethal. But the idea that there would be a group versus group warfare just doesn't make any sense in terms of the way that the societies are organized. You want to develop friendships, and they do. You want to have connections across group lines. You may need to go over to a neighboring area where there are resources when you don't have those resources. For instance, if there's a drought, you need to move around and have free access to different areas. So some of these ideas that we get in our modern nation states that there are boundaries and that we would defend these borders and we keep people out. Another one is the whole idea of scarcity, a scramble for resources. In fact, the nomadic hunter-gatherers, they share. They're just sharing like crazy within the group and amongst groups. So basically a model that is emerging here is our natural tendencies are to be cooperative, to be sharing, to be very social, like to interact, get positive rewards from interacting in a pro-social way, which is most of social life. I mean, how could it be any different? So the warfare is something that has come rather recently as we've had increase in population and complex social organizations, and especially a shift towards a social hierarchy. Here's yet another feature. These nomadic bands, they tend to be very egalitarian. Males and females are not in a strict hierarchy. Females are doing gathering for the most part, but not exclusively. Males are doing the hunting, but they don't interfere with each other. People get along well. I don't want to oversell this. Of course, there's conflicts and disputes, but they're dealt with through discussion or in sometimes contests. But the point is, the overall pattern is that people need other people, and therefore they're sharing, they're cooperating, they need to do this. And actually, I think there's a real important parallel for our 21st century. We need each other on this planet today. We're very much interlinked with our economies, and especially with global warming. And it's very analogous to the hunter-gatherer band out there in the environment, where you need the people in the next band over. You don't want to go and kill them. Why would you do that anyway? But on our planet today, we are interdependent in some of the same ways that our ancestors have been. And I actually see this as a good reason for hope, that we are really good cooperators. And if we can just manage to get our vision on this, that, oh, okay, we're on the same planet, we're facing very dangerous situations, there's many serious challenges, it's just foolish to get involved with more wars and fight with each other. We really need to work together.
I wanted you to just touch on the development of the nation state and how that affected war in general, but also power and insecurity.
We tend to live in the present and just take for granted that it's always been this way because it's this way now. Nation states are just a few hundred years old, actually. And Charles Darwin talks about the tribes have been able to come together and identify with each other. And then even he's thinking of England, you know, in the 1800s. You have some identity at the nation level at this point. So there's really no reason why then the different races, the different religions, and the different nations could come to a higher identity. And I think actually we're well on the path to that. So you have the nationalism, but at the same time, in the 21st century, you do have emerging higher level of identity with humanity overall. Humans are very flexible, so we can identify at different levels, and we can identify at different levels simultaneously. I like to call it expanding the us. There's the us and the them, but who is the us and the them? We're flexible with this. So there didn't used to be nation states. Now we identify with that. So it's just moved to another level of social evolution here. Expand the us to the whole planet and understand that, like our hunter-gatherer ancestors, we need to work together to solve these problems, not fight it out, as we've become accustomed to doing in recent history.
I also think we should go back to a worldview that hunter-gatherers had in the past and those extant often do today, and that is the sense that the other animals on the planet and other life forms and entities are part of us, and that we are all part of a common self, because we've lost that notion, and that's helping us to easily destroy our habitat now. And if we don't turn back very quickly and soon, we are going to lose ourselves as well.
Brian Ferguson, you've also written about the preconditions of peace.
Right. Your question, how did we get here with all the war? If I'm saying there's a time without war, well, that's obviously long ago. And you can look at that different ways. How do we get to the modern world we live in here in the United States? Or why is it that among tribal peoples we see around the world today, there's so much war? That's undeniable. And I'm saying that those tribal peoples are not the way archaeology says tribal peoples were 10,000 years ago. So why the change? I've written about what I call preconditions for war. These are social conditions which together make the onset of war more likely. And there's a whole list of them, such as leading a more sedentary or settled down existence, or concentrated resources, higher population density, the existence of social and political hierarchy. When I look at modern wars, the focus is always on the political leaders. That's where I think you have to look for understanding modern wars. But these things develop and they make the onset of war more likely. And these preconditions have gotten more common all over the world over time, over the millennia, which is one reason why war has become so common on planet Earth. But it's not the whole story. There are also preconditions for peace. And these include other social patterns, patterns of cooperation between different groups, of exchange and trade and intermarriage between different groups, recognized mechanisms of conflict resolution that people can go to, valorization, making valuable peaceful ideals. These things make the onset of war less likely. One of the most fascinating things I found in recent research I did for Doug's book was that one area of the Near East would seem to be very exceptional. It's an area called the Southern Levant. This is the eastern Mediterranean, basically Lebanon, Jordan, parts of Israel, parts of southern Syria. It's an area where plants and animals were first domesticated. We've got excellent archaeological recovery from the area going back to 13,000 years ago. And one of the things that's truly remarkable is that when you look at the other areas of the Near East, like in Turkey or in the northern Tigris area, which is the area that I believe war began in, or look at Europe, you find evidence of war beginning 6,000 years ago, sometimes earlier, certainly within a few thousand years of the onset of agriculture. In the southern Levant, although there are a couple of suspected cases, there's one site that was burned over, and it could have been from an attack, but it could have been from something else. There's a period of about 10,000 years, from about 13,000 B.C. to 3,000 B.C., where there is not one unambiguous case where you can look at it and say, there is war. And you can do that for everywhere else, multiple times. And my inference from this, and looking at other aspects of these preconditions for peace, is that those people who first domesticated nature also domesticated conflict. They had certainly good preconditions for war. They had ecological crises, but no signs of war, where in other areas, ecological crises, tons of war. And then it comes to a crashing halt in 3200 B.C., and the area where you can't find one single fortified village, unambiguous fortification for 10,000 years previously, every single area is fortified after 3200 B.C. And what happened? The rise of the pharaohs in Egypt. And Egypt had an extensive colony. It had it for 500 years before this in the southern Levant. But now it was an imperial colony. And the Egyptians put up the first wall, and the people of the southern Levant started building their walls at the same time. And this is another thing that got us to where we are in the world today, that when you get expansionist imperial states, it generates warfare among people all around their peripheries. And the prime example of that has been the expansion of the Euro-American system since the time of Columbus, which has generated warfare among tribals in every continent where they've impinged.
That's a very good place to end. Let me thank the three of you. Douglas Fry is Director of Peace Mediation and Conflict Research at Abo Akademi University in Finland. He's the author of Beyond War, The Human Potential for Peace. Darshan Narvaez is Professor of Psychology at the University of Minnesota and co-author of numerous books, including Evolution, Early Experience in Human Development. R. Brian Ferguson is Professor of Anthropology at Rutgers University, and he is author of numerous publications such as Born to Live, Challenging Killer Myths, and Yanomami Warfare, A Political History. That's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to producers Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can get it from kpfk.org and click on the archives, or from scholarcircle.org.